you know, the name of this podcast is Lift Every Voice, which I obviously I took from a what became subtitled the Negro National Anthem.
Right. One day I'm going to commit the second verse to it.
Yeah, you know.
Dave Chappelle is the only one I know that can go from beginning to end.
Stony the road we trod.
Right. I was like, wait, you know the bridge and the second verse? I didn't know that. Okay.
But I'd love to go through history to some people in this Black History Month. I got a cheat sheet here, but are there some seminal songs that when you think of, and I'll share this with you, but I don't know if they're, I don't want to, like, I told my staff when I looked at this list, I said, I think The Revolution Will Not Be Televised is a seminal song that needs to be, if you're thinking about the history of African American music and culture, it needs to be there.
Absolutely should be included, yes.
Yeah. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Lift Every Voice. Thanks for listening today. And I'm actually really excited because I have somebody who it's not only I consider a friend, but really somebody that I am inspired by, I look up to, and I'm grateful for. Podcast is going to actually focus on music. I'm now sitting in front of one of the most talented, creative musical artists of our time, Questlove. He's looking around the room like, who am I talking about?
Who, me?
he's actually best known for being the drummer and band leader of The Roots.
Yes.
But the reality is you're also a producer, you're an author, you're a professor, you're a DJ, you're a modern day philosopher and everyday activist. And I'm just grateful you're here,
man. I am. Okay.
You are.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We first connected, I just remember seeing you in a, well, I can't remember what Jersey college it was during one of the elections. Obama,
that's right.
Yeah, you were holding it down.
Yeah.
And you were willing to go for the Obamas. You just did yeoman's labor.
Extremely. I insisted on that. They wanted me to do speeches and rally. And I was like, no, I want to get sandwiches for people, DJ for people, motivate people. You know, I was the guy that was ringing the bell to remind people that you have like an hour left to vote and, you know, wearing the signs on the corner. Like, that was me.
I love it. Hold on. I got more nice things to say.
Oh, no.
Okay. I think it's really appropriate, especially you and I think we're about the same age. I might be a little older than you. But we've been celebrating Black History Month for a long time, and I don't think music gets the kind of focus. And so we're going to have a conversation about the influence of music, songs, and artists that have really defined and reflected the Black experience in America. I think something that you are always reaching deep from our history as well as charting a course for our future through your artistry.
Okay, thank you.
And so much of that, the songs really have also been about the struggle for righteousness, for justice, to be a conscience of our country. And I know for me, you know, whether it was the coded songs of the Underground Railroad and gospel music, civil rights era, to even our generation of African Americans, music has played a critical role, not just an important role, but a essential role in the efforts for a more just, true America. In fact, I still remember this moment where Kamala Harris and I were sitting down right before we were doing a serious thing, and I said, "You got to listen to this, see this video of Childish Gambino." And I pulled out his "This is America." Yeah, okay. And you see the two of us huddled over this thing, just in awe of that incredible video.
It's kind of weird how, you know, our perception of what I guess everyday people see politicians, and oftentimes we don't see them as relatable. But I guess since the age of social media, where you can now see past the velvet rope, the access, and you get to see a more humanized version of them. I'm really often shocked at the sort of musical, kind of relatable essence that people have. I was none more shocked than I was in the last months at the White House with the Obamas.
Yes.
Because even then, I was like, very not guarded, but very careful, because, you know, you come to the White House and you're thinking, like, in your mind, you're thinking of like fanfare by trumpets.
Yes.
You know, whatever, like, pomp and circumstances, like that kind of thing in the background. And like the last thing you're expecting is to hear like Chance the Rapper.
Right.
But yeah, I've learned in the last 10 years how crucial music plays a role in sort of gathering people together. And
well, I remember from their early inaugural event where they had Jay-Z and Beyonce playing mm-hmm. at the White House.
Yeah.
The truthfulness that comes out of African-American music is it's unadulterated truth-telling about, you know, it's like Mississippi Goddamn. Mm-hmm. It's like Strange Fruit.
Right.
It's just like speaking to pain and hurt and injustice in a way that you can trace it really from the coded songs of slavery all the way to just the profound rap of our generation, where mm-hmm. there's a way of telling the truth in a way that's also entertaining, but really speaking to something. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. There's an artist that I've long admired that really had to, you know, pay for his truth telling. There's a gentleman by the name of Eugene McDaniels who, I think in the 60s, he penned, what was the name of the song? Oh, Trying to Make It Real Compared to What? He did that for Eddie Jefferson in the 60s. So it was sort of like a well-loved soul jazz song. But he released these two records that were probably the most unfiltered truth-telling that I've ever heard in any type of soul record, not in a poetic Curtis Mayfield way or in sort of that blue collar Bill Withers way, but really opening the wounds. Probably the only person I know that can get that close to it was Nina Simone. But
yeah.
Apparently legend has it that at the time when these records were released, Spiro T. Agnew was the Vice President of the United States, and he had sort of got wind of one of these albums, and as a result, Eugene McDaniels, his musicians union card was taken away.
Wow.
And there was like he was pretty much blacklisted from being a solo artist. So,
but that makes me think, in a way, African-American music has been dangerous from its beginning.
Oh.
From slaves and the songs that they sung and the coded message, all the way to the hip hop of our generation, which
literally every creation, though. I mean, if you think about it, now we revere jazz as America's true art, but back then those guys were just heroin addicts, and the entire disco sucks movement was mired in coded race and homophobia language that plagued it, as the same with hip hop being very dangerous and watched, you know. So pretty much literally every creation of African American music. There's one particular fact that I'm not sure that people are aware of. So the very first recorded song by an African American is called The Laughing Song. And the only way that I could really describe it, probably it would have been the NWA of its day.
Wow.
And the reason why it was The Laughing Song, I didn't realize that pre-Reconstruction era period, Jim Crow Reconstruction period, I didn't realize that laughing in public for African Americans was illegal. Hence the idea of the term barrel of laughs.
Yes.
So the term barrel of laughs came from, like, if you were laughing, you were seen as sassing, which is often a coded word that blacks hear a lot, you know, even in our, you know, well, did you sass me or did you talk back to me? That sort of thing. So yeah. Laughing was seen as illegal. So the idea of a barrel is a barrel full of water,
right,
that was used to suppress any emotion. if you had to cry, if you had to scream, if you had to laugh, any sort of emotion was not allowed. So you would dunk your head in the water to suppress the sound,
right?
So that you could avoid punishment. So the idea of laughing in public was so taboo for African Americans that the very first recorded song was kind of a sarcastic dig, if you will, that ha ha ha, I'm laughing, you can't stop, like right. That sort of thing. The very first recorded song was kind of a celebratory protest that, again, the song was more sarcastic, like laughing in the face of crying, that sort of thing.
I love that about Black culture, is that they would take the worst that you could give them, mm-hmm. turn it into culinary delights that we still eat today. Take the worst that you give them, turn it into businesses and opportunity, like mm-hmm. Madam C.J. Walker, you know, not allowed to sort of have other access. And then here you have music often that is reflecting what you gave us, but we're going to turn pain and hurt from the blues to jazz. We're going to turn this into an expression that not only is healing and nurturing and nourishing to the African-American community, but actually transcends and becomes a global phenomenon.
Exactly. Even as we speak right now, this marks the 35th anniversary of Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Oh, wow.
A piece of work that has pretty much kind of been the adhesive for modern music making, and, you know, it's still in the record books as the greatest selling album of all time. And it wasn't until last year that I realized how depressing of an album Thriller is. Like, if you think of it, you know, I guess in terms, if you think of Michael Jackson's entertainment, you think of like the singing, the dancing, the joy that's brought to millions of people and that sort of thing. But when you dissected each of those songs, like literally the first song's about paranoia, even the love songs are about abandonment. It's a Thriller. I mean, you know, it's a horror song.
Yeah.
Beat, it's about a gang war. Like literally,
wow.
Human Nature's about existentialism, like the questioning the meaning of a higher being. Like literally, there's literally no joyful moment on Thriller, yet it's the happiest thing that, you know, that we embraced back in 1982. Like it's the thing that brought us together.
Yes.
It's like, wow. It's almost like Thriller was like a blues album, but it was so perfectly presented and disguised, and the opposite reaction was had, this joyous noise. But really, it's like a very depressing album.
Right. But you know, like, I turn on a blue, like, Nobody Loves Me But My Mother, but she might be jiving too. You know, you and you enjoy it, though. It actually, you know, I would watch my dad. Like, I really, my entree into music was my father, who was the first Black salesman hired by IBM in the Virginia area, thanks to the Urban League and others. Mm-hmm. And so I'm growing up now in Jersey. He's working in Manhattan. He would come home at the end of the day. It's almost like I couldn't talk to him until he got in. He would take an album out, mm-hmm. put it on the record place, put something on, and I would just see him heal from a day in, you know, corporate America, like return him to his roots in the mountains of North Carolina. And it was amazing how sustaining music was in his life. I could not touch the radio station, you know, in the car. He would listen to WBGO, which is the New York area.
How long has that been in existence?
Oh, God, going back since I was a kid. I mean, it's...
See, I thought WBGO was brand new. I'm, as a new New Yorker, and new New Yorker as in under 10 years.
Yeah.
I thought, like, WBGO was, like, my little new discovery. Like, oh, this new jazz station from 9 years ago. I didn't realize that it was historical.
No, this going back to the 70s, and people listen to WBGO around now on the globe.
That's all I listen to, literally.
Really?
It's WBGO is like the only thing that relaxes me.
And my father taught me through WBGO, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker. I mean, I was one of the few kids in my community who knew who Alberta Hunter was,
right.
You know, And so I saw what it did for my father and my mother,
right.
Not to mention to be able to put on Richard Pryor albums. And you know, for me, it just seemed so dirty and naughty. But
right.
I realized that even our comedians were speaking to the pain of a community, to the hurt of the community.
I grew up in a family with about 3,000 to 5,000 albums. for me,
3,000 to 5,000 albums.
Yeah, well, my dad was a musician. I mean, everyone in my family was their own record collector, and TV really wasn't big in the house, but music was. And I didn't go outside a lot, so for me, an average day was just those big giant headphones into my dad's stereo and imagining pre-videos. Like, you'd have to imagine what Songs in the Key of Life was like in your head when you're listening to Stevie Wonder. But I always tell the story of that jazz, as much as I'd like to present this rosy childhood that I had with you know, my musical family and stuff, but jazz was like, jazz was punishment to me in the house.
Wow. Wow.
Well, because there's always a point when, right before you become a teenager, you discover your own music. And, you know, that, which is why I laugh. Black has recently had an episode where everyone in the family is highly dismayed that the youngest twins have this sort of indifference attitude to who Prince is.
Right.
Which was the exact opposite of my childhood, which was like, Prince was like banned in the household. And so every time I purchased a Prince 45 or a Prince album, then it was like, my dad was like, no, listen to John Coltrane. So for me, it was like, it's weird. Like, yes, I have a beautiful relationship with jazz now, but you know.
Well, Prince was my awakening in many ways, because my brother and I broke out, and I should give my brother the credit. I mean, when he got Controversy, it was,
you have an older brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Trickle Down.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. I mean, I played Controversy. There's a song on there called Free.
Right.
That it was, I would just play that song over and over again. But
right.
So Speak to Me, we talk about pain, like everything from We shall not be moved to talk about, it's talking about counter to oppression. Mm-hmm. You have Tracks of My Tears. I can go through, you now made me think of Thriller in all different way, but there is Black Joy.
Absolutely.
In some of the songs as well. Can you speak to me about that?
Absolutely. For me, one of my favorite periods of Motown is, of course, when producer Norman Whitfield sort of came aboard as a staff producer. And Norman Whitfield was probably the last in that classic 60s era of Motown that came aboard as a producer. And he kind of has ears to the street, and being influenced by Sly and the Family Stone and what was happening in the 60s, Love Revolution, he sort of took all those ideas and put it into his music. So as a result, the kind of suit and tie Motown presentation of the early Temptations and Diana Ross and the Supremes, and, you know, now the new version of the Temptations, which they really dealt with war protest songs in a way that I felt was really potent and relatable. But even when Eddie Kendricks broke away from the Temptations to make his first solo record, he made an album in 1971 called My People Hold On, which, although unfortunately, because of the meteoric rise of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On album, kind of overtook it. My People Hold On is kind of one of my favorite Eddie Kendricks Motown political projects, which is really, no one truly defined Afrocentricity. I guess it just became to be. Of course, like Soul Train was just coming into shape, and Soul Train was defined in Afrocentricity. So this idea that Black is beautiful, that you're worth something, that sort of thing. He really, really kind of nails it on that album. So even though it wasn't a hit per se, My People Hold On by Eddie Kendricks is one of my notable moments of Afrocentricity. Right. You know, because there's different types of music. There's protest music, message music, and then sometimes you need affirmation music to build yourself up. Bill Withers was also very good at that.
Powerful.
People don't necessarily consider, I mean, Lean On Me is almost like could be more of a personal song from friend to friend.
Right.
But, you know, often you could use Lean On Me just as as almost a message song as well in that regard.
Last night, cleaning out my office, I found a card from my mom many Christmases ago, a picture of an elderly African-American woman in her house, and she starts the long letter to me off that I had to get you this card because it reminded me of that Bill Withers song. And it just shows you that here's my mother talking about being sourced and grounded by that and connected to her.
Everyone seems to have a Bill, everyone that I meet that's of my age, like I always thought like, oh, that's just my song and my song.
Right, alone. Right.
But everyone has their version of what grandmom's hands meant to them.
Yes.
And their parents or their grandparents.
So let me ask you this, because I obviously see you in the public sphere and you are not a leader that is speaking to just the Black community. You are, mm-hmm. you transcend in many ways through your leadership, through your work. And I just want to ask you about how, because we're sitting here talking about Black music, but we both know that African-American music has shaped global culture. I mean, you can go through the influences that it's had. And, you know, I always say about my own Black experience that I luxuriate in my culture, in my the food and music. But for me, it's like a portal that gives me sort of the strength and the grounding to have a deeper love and appreciation for all of humanity. And I'm mm-hmm. wondering if you could talk a little bit about that connective tissue that has sort of been the gift of the African-American experience through music to this world.
You know, initially, especially the way that my group got its start, we spent our first 4 to 5 years living in Europe almost wow. exclusively. I mean, as a band, even
what years were that?
I'll say 93, 94. We literally would take our advance money. We got a hub in London and just stayed there. And it's weird that we had to run for cover in Europe simply because by 1993, people often wonder like, well, you know, what was the turning point or even the tipping point for Black artistry in America where it wasn't the same as it once was.
Sounds like Nina Simone, James Baldwin kind of going over to Europe.
That's exactly what we did. Well, we called it pulling a Hendrix.
Okay.
Hendrix had to do the same thing. There really truly wasn't an outlet for us as a band living in the United States that would fully embrace us. Whereas in Europe, still in 1993, there were jam sessions. I mean, not to say, you know, there's still in New Orleans, places in Chicago, in the Bay Area, even parts of, surprisingly, Jacksonville, Florida. Like, there are still specks of music culture, as in any given town that can have anywhere between 20 to 30 bands playing in a 12-block radius, which is almost unheard of in New York City.
Right.
Like there's a lot of salsa bands like way up in the heights in New York City on a given week night. But for us, there really wasn't a community of musicians that we could sort of dive into and melt with. So we had to move to London. I was shocked. Like the first year and a half, I was just kind of mind blown that something so pure and so embedded into my soul, something like that created me, was almost evaporating before my very eyes. And even my A&R said, well, Amir, you guys realize that you're the last Black band with a record deal, right? And I was like, "Huh?" And that was 1993.
Wow.
I mean, now you can't even count groups anymore. Like literally, I think Migos and Ray Shremmer are the last groups. Like right now, it's just about solo mission. I mean, we could say the Carters, but they're married. So just the idea of community and collaboration is an almost endangered species territory. So I'll say that living in Europe for those first 5 years, and I mean like, not like we have it today where it's like, okay, we're in our luxury five-star right, hotel right. and go straight to the gig. Like we were living amongst the people. So, you know, sometimes crashing on couches and that sort of thing. So, and this is before the internet. I was shocked how much Black culture and Black music played a vital role into how the world operates. Half the people that are still my friends now, I mean, they're in their 40s and 50s. a lot of them were like, yeah, MTV Raps is how I learned English.
Wow.
Which is crazy to me. I'm like, seriously? It's like, yeah, we would just record your MTV Raps, write down all the lyrics, study them. And then that was their motivation to learn English because they thought it was cool. So,
wow. Do they still say like you be illin and stuff like that?
No. Now they're like delegates and they work for, you know, the head of state. They're like, it's like Kaiser Sosa at the end of Usual Suspects. Like they blended into, you know, modern society. But yeah, back then it was just strictly slang. Our culture, there's just a cool element that's absolutely unavoidable. I want people to embrace their culture and be proud of it. Because oftentimes, especially in hip-hop circles that I've seen, I'll see that people will neglect their own,
right.
Their own identity because mine seems more, cooler at the moment.
Well, I love what Gandhi says about this. He says, honor your incarnation. Like you were born who you were.
I truly believe it.
Yeah.
And I absolutely believe that. So what we gripe about now is that, you know, our culture is often used as kind of like boutique shopping. Like, okay, I like those buttons. I like the tie. You can keep the shirt. I'll take the jacket and the, which in today's society, it's like, okay, well, we'll take the dancing, the slang, all your life troubles and what you go through every day.
Right.
You can keep that. Because oftentimes you'll hear, well, I like Kendrick Lamar.
Right.
But people think that, that can be their shield. Like, okay, well, I listen to this person, so that doesn't make me, culturally insensitive or that sort of thing. So for me, it's oftentimes on social media, without having to publicly embarrass, because I know, like, if I address a particular person, then a couple million people are watching it.
Right.
I've had to have a few sort of DM conversations where I just kind of express that I know you want to seem cool by saying this particular word or whatever, but you got to know the repercussions of how painful that is.
Right.
You know? Sometimes it works. Sometimes it falls on deaf ears, but there's still a ways to go. I mean, it's still happening.
And it's interesting because I have this belief in America now. We have so much common pain, but we're lacking that sense of common purpose. I've traveled now from Midwestern farmers to people in Appalachia to folk in my community, inner city New York, and I just see a lot of the same common pain, but we're lacking the poverty that bothers me most often is the poverty of empathy, the poverty of understanding, poverty of compassion, but also this understanding that we are connected to each other in pretty intricate ways that we don't understand. And music, sometimes the best that music often does is remind people of those commonalities, where you have someone where you or I might be moved by an Irish ballad and it touches something in us that actually is the same emotion that the artist was trying to get, that's what makes me hopeful about the expressions of our culture.
You know, it's weird now. Music is so abundant in its options. It's borderline like overwhelming.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes people are asking me like, well, who do I look to? And where's, the people complain like, music isn't like it was back in the day. The difference between now and then, I'll say then a cool tastemaker could be the person that determines what's cool or not cool. And now we're in a time where the gatekeeper sort of determines what's cool and what's not cool, which, if you're the gatekeeper, if you're a radio station owner or that sort of thing,
right.
You determining what's cool is a little bit weirder than a person that's a music expert that determines what gets out there. I'll say that, one of the beautiful things about the internet, is that, if you put extra effort in there, there's some trusted blogs and, trusted, people that I look to, that Excuse me.
No.
I was trying to cover that up. Like, sorry about that. No, there's you know, there's trusted sources that I look to, because oftentimes, and this has been since the beginning of time, like, you can't look towards kind of mainstream sources to get messages. For me, the subculture, the underground, you know, for every mainstream success, I can, you know, there's 20 other artists that are bubbling under that people don't know about. Huh. It's overwhelming now, because even in this one device, there are over 7 billion songs created, right, that you might not have the patience to sift and, right, and search, right, for. It just takes a little more needle haystacking patience than ever before.
And so there is a democratization going on in some ways. You know, you can get, people can be discovered on YouTube, or, but is that democratization great, but is the segmentation bad, that I don't have to expose myself now? I can cultivate my music and avoid having to listen to things that actually might stretch me or help me to grow.
That's, yeah, that's the weird thing. Like, I'm very lucky to have grown up in a time period where I trusted a DJ and their knowledge to put me on to things that I wouldn't have known. Anyone that is of age, my age, that grew up in Detroit, I envy them more than anything. Mm-hmm. I ask about, what was it like to hear the electrifying mojo in Detroit City? Like, this is a guy who introduced ideas of, like, Afrofuturism. His everyday playlist was like somewhere between Gil Scott-Heron, Kraftwerk, George Clinton, Eddie Hazel, Marlena Shaw. Like, it was such a I found some of his playlist on the internet, and I'm like, this guy was like the first shuffle option of music. Like, today that would be so not allowed. Like, I often dreamed of, you know, of all my jobs, if I had to add a 15th, like, I kind of want to be America's DJ. Metaphorically speaking, like, if I'm left to my own devices, I would live off of peanut butter Captain Crunch 24/7.
Right.
Like, what? No, salad. Forget that. Give me more Captain Crunch. You know, and that's dangerous.
But these algorithms, like, I have to admit to you, like, so I get so busy that I just, like, often go with what I know. And I still remember my algorithm on this platform spit out this guy to me, and I'm embarrassed to tell you I didn't know who he was. Who's this Ocean guy? You know,
Frank Ocean.
I went down this rabbit hole where I just was like, oh, how could I have not heard of this guy?
It's possible.
I'm not up on country, and I'm sure there's lots of great country songs that I would actually really appreciate.
Well, it's funny you say that. A month ago, I was determined, you know, because I know, like, there's this perception of me, like, being the all-knowing musical.
You are the oracle of music.
The idea of the oracle. And then I was like, if someone were to test my knowledge on country, then I might be kind of up the creek there. But then there was one particular week where I committed, like, 5 hours a night, like, from 9 p.m. to, like, almost 3 in the morning, where I just fell down an endless rabbit hole of blogs of, wow, writers that I liked. And I didn't realize, like, how much I liked Bobby Gentry, Johnny Adams, Larry John Wilson. Because the thing is that oftentimes when country artists would come on The Tonight Show, and it's weird, like, of all the acts to come on, you're often moved by the things that you underestimate. So in the very beginning of doing the Fallon show, country acts would come on. I'd be like, okay. Really? I didn't think I'd be into that. And then start researching it. And, you know, once I realized that how potent and how strong, like, musicianship is, especially in Nashville, started doing further research, and a lot of, especially in the 70s. Oh my God, there were so much funky songs.
Yes, coming out of country.
And in the country
world. So first of all, how can I get down? I mean, I want you to be my DJ. So do you have, like, we both use Spotify. I see that on the platform. Can I access one of your country lists to expose myself?
I will be a guru. Absolutely.
Can we make it accessible to the people listening to the podcast?
Yes, I will. I will promise you. I will link them in all platforms from Spotify to Pandora to Tidal.
Be my country guide.
Yes, I will be that
Questlove
guy.
Questlove is going to be my guide into country music.
Well, that's the. You know what's weird? That's the problem, and this is the thing that hip hop has learned about that we learned a little too late. Because oftentimes we're like, well, how come things that we took for granted, we thought were cool, aren't translating to the next generation?
Right.
And sometimes I'll ask those guys, like, well, did you teach, like, how many people have you specifically taught about James Brown? Like, something that you think is so pedestrian, like, oh, everyone knows about Michael Jackson.
No,
you cannot take that for granted. So for me, my New York Times crossword puzzle is making playlists.
Right.
And just recently, First Lady Michelle Obama asked me to create a playlist for her book, Becoming. She wanted just like 50 songs. I kind of went overboard and did 1,000.
What? Man, I need that. Because I just started reading her book. This education, like when I learned who Harry Chapin was, it was through a friend of the family who told me his story, what motivated him. And I fell in love with him even before I really, the only song I knew, I think, was Cats in the Cradle.
Right.
But then when I knew a lot more about him, I went deep into the rabbit hole and felt this connection to this guy who lived to solve the hunger crisis, who was tragically killed. I mean, it was almost like I had a guide, a Sherpa, into his music, and now his music became alive for me even more. And so I'm like that too. When I learn about an artist from African-American music, even, that I didn't know, there, like Alberta Hunter's story is amazing. I mean, she was retired from music, couldn't make it in the music industry, was rediscovered in, I think, her 60s, when she was elderly,
later.
And just killed it. And so your ability to, when you say you're going to blogs and learning history, I actually do think that that awakens us to the meaning of music. It touches the soul in a way that is universal. And I do get back to that idea of, it's the connective tissue in our society, art and culture.
Right.
It's not only an internal experience, but it's an external connective experience, I think, is really important.
And plus, you know, oftentimes you have to want to leave your comfort zone. And I'm guilty of that a lot. Like, I will stay on a playlist forever because I know it and it's part of my creative DNA and those sort of things. But music is so important to me that, like, I'll use Sunday as a day that, you know, if I don't discover, and it doesn't have to be overwhelming, for me to discover 10 songs that I really, that move my soul, I feel like that's enough. And I take like 5 hours. And again, I know it's I have the luxury of taking out 5 hours to do something. Whereas,
but it's not, I think for you, it's what makes you unique. It's I don't think it's a luxury. I think it's a urgency, a necessity for you being who you are and being of service to others.
Yeah, I want to discover it so I can share it with other people. Yes. My inner circle, even with my podcast, my five other cohorts on Questlove Supreme, they're so knowledgeable, way beyond me. Like, I wanted to make sure that I was the least knowledgeable person in that circle. A lot of my friends are people to whom know way more than I do. And I seek that out. Like, I have to be the least knowledgeable person of music in my circle.
I hate to steal Prince's title, but musicology. Let's have a musicology moment where we're gifting people as we roll up. This is not the Michelle Obama's playlist, but this is in some ways America's playlist. Like,
okay.
Like, let's go through, you know, the name of this podcast is Lift Every Voice, which I obviously I took from what became subtitled the Negro National Anthem.
Right.
But I'd love to go through history to some people in this Black History Month. I got a cheat sheet here, but are there some seminal songs that when you think of, and I'll share this with you, but I don't know if they're, I don't want, like, I told my staff when I looked at this list, I said, Gil Scott-Heron is not on this. Like, I think The Revolution Will Not Be Televised is a seminal a song that needs to be, if you're thinking about the history of African American music and culture, it needs to be there.
Absolutely should be included. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there's a gazillion Gil Scott Heron songs. For me, a lot of the unchampioned underground groups that should deserve mention. There's a group called Samande. They have a song called The Message.
God, I don't know this stuff. Do I need to write it down, or are you going to?
I will. Yes, I will. I will share it all with you. All Samande's right. The Message. There's even some songs that you don't, that are so good, so mainstream, you won't even know that they're message songs. Alan Toussaint wrote Yes We Can initially about 10 years before the Pointer Sisters covered it in the 70s. That's imperative. Jazz musician Gary Bartz has a song called Celestial Blues, kind of encouraging in its message of unity. That's important. There's Baby Huey and the Babysitters, discovery of Curtis Mayfield from Chicago. Unfortunately, he only had one album, but a song called Hard Times. That's important. A band, I forget where the Skull Snaps are from. They might be from Virginia. They have a song called It's a New Day.
You got a lot of people listening right now. They're on their Spotify putting these things in.
I will link you this. For me, you know, James Brown was probably, a lot of people see Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, as one of his important songs, but there's a song that he did in 1970 called Get On Up, Get Into It, Get Involved, which for me, I'll say the last protest marches that I've been to, the one thing that was truly lacking, a good soundtrack. For me, that song has exclamation points after it.
Now, are a lot of geniuses like James Brown and Michael Jackson, I know, was the same way. I've heard stories how much of a perfectionist they were. Like, I mean, he would dock members of his band, James Brown,
yes,
if they did something wrong. And people, they were almost afraid of him. I mean, he really was. The performance that we see that's celebrated today is just the front for incredible work. He was called the hardest working man in show business for a reason, right?
Indeed, he was. I mean, he was his own one-man revolution.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes, I mean he broke ground. I mean he really was shattering new ground.
Yeah, it's often said that. I mean, whenever I kind of frown when I hear this whole like pull yourself up by your bootstraps thing, but he was literally the definition of that because of his background. You put all your energy and your emotion into that. So,
but is that's a part of the human condition that you turn your biggest pain,
poverty and
trauma,
and pain,
hardships into incredible expressions of humanity, artistry, genius, invention.
Yes. A lot of his life is a miracle because it shouldn't have happened, you know, by the numbers, by statistics of where his life was headed for him to wind up in that position, was indeed a miracle. We should also, of course, I should hope that Marvin Gaye is, of course, I see it. It's definitely on your list.
Yeah, yeah. You and I weren't born yet. I'm looking at the years. This is my year, my birth.
I'm 71.
Okay, so I am a little older than you, man. So
you know, you're 30 to me, you know.
So I'm 69, and I guess Sly and the Family Stone, my team put the song that came out there, Everyday People. I like Sly and the Family Stone. Sweet Honey and Rock was come. When did they come together? That was much later, though.
Sweet Honey and Rock was in the, I believe, the mid-70s.
Okay.
In the mid-70s, yeah. Same for Sweet Honey and Rock.
I have a song that I, a couple of their songs I'll play to psych myself up for public speaking at times. You know, we who believe in freedom. I can't believe you got me singing, man, but cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until.
So you have to psych yourself up for a speech?
Maybe psyching myself up is the wrong way to do it. It's to put me in the mood, in the zone, help me channel that, like that energy.
I'm the only person that I know I have to, silence is the song I listen to before any. I don't know if it's a meditation thing or, you know, or clearing my mind thing, but I'm often nervous before speeches, not performing. Performing is like, you know, chewing.
But you might know this because I experienced this when I was an athlete, and I experience it now when I'm giving a good speech. It's getting myself out of my own way. Like you start to disappear and you feel like you're channeling something. like when I was running the hurdles, I would suddenly feel like I almost, you know, it wasn't me, you know, I was just, you know, channeling an energy. And so sometimes when I'm speaking, when I'm really just dissolving and just trying to connect with the audience, I don't know if you have that feeling.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned this. There's this story I'm going to tell that I'd rarely ever tell. As a music curator, who really takes his job almost too serious, sometimes you just have bad nights.
Yeah.
So between myself and the Obamas, who will swear and insist that that was the most perfect night of music ever, for me, I was such a perfectionist about the last time I DJ'd for them. Like, I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown, only because, like, I had prepared for it, like, months in advance. Like, in my house, there was, like, a police chart of, like, graphs and everything. Like, okay, well, this song's in this particular key, and that's 93 beats per minute, so I could segue into this, and then turn
into... Oh, my gosh.
Like, that's the type of...
What was that movie where the guy had all the stuff written out? Beautiful Mind.
Yes, that is how I prepare for DJ sets. Like, I overthink everything that the average person will just be like, why did he go from the Beatles to Funkadelic like that? So... You know, first I was just going to shrug it off. They were like, he was like, you did a good job. I enjoyed it. I was like, thanks. And he's like, you didn't enjoy it? And I was just like, oh, man, he's got enough. Like, let me just, I just wanted to get out there because I really felt like I was going to start crying on the
really,
spot.
Really?
And you don't want to cry in front of your president.
Yeah.
So, but he took the time out. He's like, what's wrong? And I told him, you know, like, I had this whole night of this revelatory art presentation. I was going to go from Benny Goodman 1933 all the way to Drake in 2018 and presented this thing, and halfway I just gave up and just, you know, I was karaoke DJ. Just played like what the people wanted.
Yes.
And he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said, you know, you did something more honorable. And I was like, well, okay. He says, you serve the people. And see, that's important. And I was like, okay, so what do you mean? And he said that when he had to speak at the funeral in South Carolina.
Yes, yes.
He had the speech of his life prepared. Like, he knew this one was for the record books.
Yeah.
Like,
yes,
I'm going to get him with this one.
Yes.
And he said... He's like 45 seconds into it. He's like, I wasn't reaching the people. And I was like, so what happened? He says, and you can tell I'm about to call an audible because he started looking at the bottom right because he started going off script. Yeah. And of course, whenever he goes off script, his people are sort of like panicking. Like, he took 8 seconds out. He's like, all right, Barry, I'm going to sing Amazing Grace. He said, and I did it. And he's like, and he saw their body language. They all came alive.
Amen.
And so he said, I reached the people. He said, sometimes, you know, you have in your mind your own agenda that you prepare, that you think you know what's best, and da 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 da. He says, but you saw what was happening, and you just made the switch, and it, he says, I'm not exaggerating. This was the best party we've ever had in these 8 years.
That's powerful.
But then he was like, you feel better? I was like, no.
Well, first of all, another famous musician moment was Mahalia Jackson standing behind Martin Luther King.
Yes.
When he had his prepared remarks. And she's like, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. Now, I'm reading a lot of King right now because I just feel like we as a country need that beloved community that he's so I'm reading like his real stuff. I'm reading a book about his labor speeches. Just read a book called The Radical King. Mm-hmm. And I see that in his, because this was before, you know, people were recording him. So he was using the same riffs
right. A
lot of time. So he had used How Long, Not Long, The Arc of the Moral Universe. I'm seeing that in a lot of speeches.
His greatest hits.
Right. Yeah. Just he's using that to close all his speeches. So Mahalia knows his riff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not in his prepared speech. And you could hear her audibly yell out, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And he just... He folds up the prepared remarks and goes on about the dream. So here's this great musician who knew how to touch the people,
yep,
who knew what the moment needed. King didn't prepare for that, But she knew, and she encourages him to go off script and tell him about the dream, and we're talking about to this day.
And sometimes it's scary, you know, because oftentimes I think whenever you're called for a mission, and sometimes the mission requires flying, we're often thinking about what's the landing? Are we going to crash? Yeah. Are we going to get to safety? We often forget the beauty and the experience of what the flying is. So oftentimes you kind of want to be in control of everything, of knowing ahead of time what you're going to do. And sometimes you could almost take the humanity out of that. For me, even though it was scary and I wasn't prepared, I didn't know what song I was going to play next and that sort of thing. And, you know, I didn't wow them with my artistry. I was just a DJ playing for people that wanted to dance. They needed it. And because of the night that it was, being the very last week, it was almost like a spiritual cleansing.
You cannot have courage without vulnerability. And I don't think you can have greatness without vulnerability. Like, if you don't step out, as you've been saying, out of your comfort zone, treading new ground. And I think that the story you told me is inspiring to me, because you just let go of control and let the spirit use you,
right,
to connect to the larger spirit that unites us all and connects us all. And people felt that spirit. My best speeches are never the ones I write. They're often the ones where I just extemporaneously, and if I'm connecting to the larger spirit that's bigger than me, things happen, and you let things happen. It's vulnerable, it's risky, and sometimes you do crash, but I think that that's the power. And this is one of the reasons why you and I in the hip hop generation, I just love the freestyling. I love when people aren't, you know, they just are in the moment.
I love good freestyling. Big difference. Everyone's like,
take me now, you and I are alive, like 80s and 90s. Like, are there now some people, like some songs that you would put on your African-American history a playlist? Let's finish up. Let's get to you and I are now on the planet Earth.
Well, we definitely, I hope.
It's not, man. It's a
limited list. We do not see Public Enemy on this list.
Don't believe the hype.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see Fight the Power. Okay,
Fight
I overlooked.
The power, yes.
I overlooked
okay.
it. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So definitely, you ready to start running?
I'm sorry. I got a little excited there. I have to sound senatorial here.
Yeah. For me, with hip hop, probably it's best period for message music. Was no doubt between 1987 and 1992. That to me, that concentrated period of our knowledge of self.
That's when Sign of the Times came out too.
Yes. '87 was such a critical year for black music, both in hip hop, both in soul music. The onslaught of New Jack Swing.
Yes.
Kind of Prince and Michael's last shining moments as titans of the 80s, yes, that sort of thing. And with the rise of hip hop between 87 and 1992, are, I feel, hip hop's most potent period. I'm still thinking of 16-year-old Amir. Like, would this move him? Would this inspire him? Because, I mean, to be alive at that time period, to first read Malcolm X's autobiography, yes, and all that stuff, like all those things that hip hop inspired you to do, that's the type of place where, you know, we are now and still are now. And I know, you know, it's
that was
weird.
The year I read, 1987, yeah, when I first read Malcolm X's autobiography.
You know, it's weird. In 2002, I did this interview in a magazine called The Believer with Touré. And I believe that we conducted this interview maybe 4 days after the war had just started. So I think this was like March of 2002, 2003. And he was asking me my thoughts about it. And I said that, you know, I said, well, I know one thing, in times of darkness and sort of political uncertainty, I know that the musician community, they're going to come with it, yeah, and they're going to represent, yeah, and they're going to bring it. and I was so wrong. Now that I realize in hindsight, in the 70s, you know, our artists weren't balling, you know, like Curtis Mayfield wasn't making it rain.
Right.
Like they didn't,
they weren't seeing the kind of,
they were everyday
wealth.
People. I kind of thought that, okay, well, our artists are going to tell the truth. And when it didn't happen, I was so dismayed. I was just like, well, oh, okay, people have stuff to lose. You know, that, I'm sure that most people know the Natalie Mines situation from the Dixie Chicks, who had criticized the war, and then, you know, they paid dearly for speaking their truth. I feel like that rendered a lot of artists silent.
And by the way, their song in response to all that at the end. What's that? It's an amazing song. Yeah,
now
the Dixie Chicks had a comeback song after that. So nobody wants to yell it out in the background. You guys are all just disappointing me.
Caesar, you're not my.
Yes, I'm not ready to make nice. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Yeah,
I'm still hoping for that day, especially today in 2018.
Yes,
truth is needed. Now more than ever, I'm seeing a turnaround. Like Jay-Z is a great example of that turnaround period. Like I never thought that his message 20 years ago, I mean, drowning in hypercapitalism,
right,
and sort of the iniquity and the sins of his past has now turned him into Gil Scott-Heron levels of message. So I feel like there's hope that that sort of branding will come back, not as fashionable, but as necessary.
Yeah, well, I bumped into Jay-Z recently, and you know, he went right to it with me about criminal justice reform, and, mm-hmm. and you know, what is, you know, we have more African Americans under criminal supervision today than all the slaves in 1850. And I know the power of artists in our past, and I really, really believe this is a moment where this nation needs more poets. It needs more artists. It needs more fearless, self-sacrificing truth tellers. And I think if I could just point the light back on you, I just find you living in that spirit that honors the artists of the past. I really find you as one of those people who is a truth teller, but in a way that touches not just the African-American community, but I think you are a gift in many ways to our country at a time that we need to unite people around our common purpose, around our unfinished business as a nation, on our need to advance. And so, brother, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me.
Thank you.
And I'm going to go out there on country or anywhere else you want to lead me.
I'm your guru.
I love it.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.